Envision this. You're a physician in a busy primary care clinic, and today you're seeing a 52-year-old woman for a follow-up evaluation of fatigue. She tells you, "I know everybody says they're tired these days, but I really am. Normally, I'm a go-getter, but now I'm always looking to sit down and even take a nap." Based on the information that the patient shared with you, you decide to order some screening blood work. The results revealed a white blood cell count of 5.4, which is normal, a hemoglobin of 8.2, where normal is between 12 and 16, and an MCV of 111, where normal is between 80 and 100. 5 years prior, she had a weight loss surgery, a sleeve gastrectomy, in which 70 to 80% of the greater curvature of the stomach was removed. How will you explain these findings to your patient? Welcome to Audio Bricks. This is Ed Barnes breaking down anatomy and histology of the GI tract in YAYS. After completing this section, you will be able to 1. Describe the mesenteries, ligaments, and omental layers of the peritoneum. 2. Distinguish regions of the digestive tract as retroperitoneal or with mesentery. And 3. Identify and describe the anatomy, primary functions, and histology of the different segments of the GI tract. Part 1. What are the anatomy and histology of the gastrointestinal tract? The length of the gastrointestinal tract, when stretched out, is approximately 25 to 30 feet long. And there are several different organs and tissue types. The task of learning it all can be daunting and may at times feel overwhelming. With your patience, we will navigate this lengthy topic in an organized and strategic manner together. We will first start by discussing the overall GI tract. Then we'll progress down systematically organ by organ, stopping at each structure to discuss its function and histology. First, let's break down the abdomen into four different sections or quadrants, if you will. Visualize the umbilicus at the center of the quadrants, and both lines that create these quadrants intersect at the umbilical region. Let's discuss the location of each of these GI tract organs in relationship to these quadrants. First off, the esophagus sits above the quadrants and the stomach as it traverses the chest on its way from the mouth. The right upper quadrant encompasses the liver, gallbladder, stomach, and duodenum, and part of the transverse colon. The left upper quadrant includes the remainder of the stomach, the pancreas, the spleen, a small part of the liver, and the remainder of the transverse colon. Moving on to the right lower quadrant, it houses the colon, appendix, part of the rectum, and a portion of the small intestine. The final quadrant, the left lower quadrant, consists of the portion of the small intestine, large intestine, the sigmoid colon, and part of the rectum. Part 2. What is the peritoneum? There is a covering over the GI tract known as the peritoneum. And in addition to the stability and support it provides the GI tract, it also allows us to classify organs anatomically. For example, organs completely within the peritoneum, such as the stomach, are referred to as intraperitoneal, whereas organs within the abdominal cavity that are not involved in the peritoneum are called retroperitoneal, such as the kidneys. The peritoneum has two layers, visceral and parietal, and the space between the two layers is known as the peritoneal cavity. The peritoneal cavity is a potential space that is normally filled with serous fluid, which can be thought of as a bit of lubrication for the abdominal organs, to prevent friction as they move. The parietal peritoneum lines the abdominal wall. The most superficial aspect is composed of connective tissue, and it adheres tightly to the deepest layer of the abdominal muscle fascia. The visceral peritoneum is a thin membrane that lines the surface of the abdominal organs. However, the visceral peritoneum also takes on different forms to aid the normal function of the abdominal cavity. Think about it as the abdominal cavity support system. There are also different forms of visceral peritoneum, and they are mesenteries, omenta, and ligaments. These structures are collectively known as peritoneal reflections. What are mesenteries, you ask? A mesentery is a double layer of visceral peritoneum that envelops an organ and connects it to the posterior abdominal wall. Mesenteries provide a highly absorptive surface, have important immune functions, and permit movement of organs during digestion. And then, what is an omenta? An omentum is a peritoneal fold that connects the stomach to other abdominal organs. There are two omenta, the greater and lesser. These adipose-rich, specialized mesenteries separate the peritoneal cavity into smaller cavities, the greater and lesser sacs. The greater omenta starts from the greater curvature of the stomach and duodenum, travels inferiorly, folds on itself, and then goes back up superiorly to attach to the transverse colon. Think of it as an apron covering the small intestines throughout the right and left lower quadrants. It plays an important role in cushioning and insulating the abdominal organs, especially the small and large intestines. The lesser omentum extends from the lesser curvature of the stomach and the first part of the duodenum to the liver, in both the right and left upper quadrant. It is mainly composed of two well-named ligaments that we'll cover in a bit, and also contains three very important structures collectively known as the portal triad, which includes the portal vein, proper hepatic artery, and the bile duct. The lesser omentum also contains an opening known as the omental or epiploic foramen. This foramen allows communication of serous fluid between the greater and lesser sacs. The lesser sac is situated posterior to the lesser omentum, liver, and the stomach. It has three recesses. First, the superior recess, that's posterior to the stomach. Second is the inferior recess, that's posterior to the stomach with extension into the layers of the greater omentum. And third is the splenic recess, that extends lateral to the left, ending at the spleen. Now the greater sac spans the entire abdominal pelvic cavity, extending from the diaphragm to the pelvic floor. It has four recesses. First is the subphrenic or suprahepatic recess. It's inferior to the diaphragm. Next, the hepatorenal or subhepatic recess is present on the right side of the body, located between the liver and the right kidney and suprarenal gland. It communicates with the lesser sac via the epiploic foramen. Then there's the right pericolic recess or the gutter, which lies lateral to the ascending colon, communicates with the hepatorenal recess, and thus the lesser sac. And finally, the left pericolic recess or gutter, which lies lateral to the descending colon. Here's a clinical correlation to tie up the greater and lesser sacs. The greater and lesser sacs and their various recesses provide conduits through which peritoneal fluid can travel. This is important clinically in the presence of infection, inflammation, or cancer for the peritoneal spread of pathology. Peritonitis, also known as inflammation within the peritoneal cavity, can be treated with antibiotics or paracentesis, a procedure to draw liquid from the cavity, which can be both diagnostic, because the fluid can be lab tested to find a cause, and therapeutic, because removal of the fluid relieves pain and pressure the patient may be experiencing. Let's move on to the ligaments now. The numerous ligaments present throughout the peritoneal cavity provide structural support to the organs of the abdominal pelvic cavity. The two lesser omental ligaments provide a secure conduit for the portal triad. There's the hepatogastric ligament, connects the lesser curvature of the stomach to the liver, and the hepatoduodenal ligament that connects the duodenum to the liver. Then there are four greater omental ligaments you'll want to know about. First, the gastrosplenic ligament, which connects the greater curvature of the stomach to the spleen. Next, the splenorenal ligament, which connects the spleen to the left kidney. Then we have the gastrophrenic ligament, which connects the greater curvature of the stomach to the diaphragm. And finally, the gastrocolic ligament. This connects the greater curvature of the stomach to the transverse colon. Okay, I know that was a lot to go through. So let's pause now for a quick quiz. What are the four peritoneal ligaments involved with the greater omentum? The greater omentum is involved with the gastrophrenic, gastrocolic, splenorenal, and gastrosplenic ligaments. There are four other peritoneal ligaments of note to be aware of. The falciform ligament anchors the liver to the anterior abdominal wall. The ligamentum teres is remnants of the fetal umbilical vein within the falciform ligament. The coronary ligament extends from the diaphragm to the liver. And lastly, the ligamentum venosum, which is fibrous remnants of the ductus venosus. How about the peritoneal pouches? Let's dig in there. The peritoneal pouches contain peritoneal fluid and are capable of communicating with the other areas containing peritoneal fluid. Pouches are sex-dependent. Males have just one, the rectovesical pouch that lies between the rectum and the urinary bladder. Female peritoneal pouches include the vesicouterine pouch, which is between the urinary bladder and the uterus, and the rectouterine pouch, also known as the pouch of Douglas, which is between the uterus and the rectum. Part 3. What are retroperitoneal structures? The retroperitoneum is a space in the abdomen behind the posterior parietal peritoneum. Secondarily, retroperitoneal organs are lined by visceral peritoneum. Examples include the pancreas, duodenum, and ascending and descending colons. In early development, secondarily retroperitoneal organs had a true mesentery and the associated mobility. During development, a surface of the organ was pushed up against the body wall, fused to the body wall, and lost its mobility. So this explains why retroperitoneal structures do not have a true mesentery aren't in contact with the body wall. But why are they so important? Well, injuries to these structures can cause blood or gas accumulation in the retroperitoneal space. Because the GI tract loves a list, there's a catchy mnemonic that may help you remember the 11 structures of the retroperitoneum. The 11 main retroperitoneal structures are said pucker, S for suprarenal or adrenal glands, A for aorta, I for inferior vena cava, D for duodenum, P for pancreas except the tail, U for ureters, C for colon, descending and ascending, K for kidneys, E for esophagus, and R for rectum. Said, pucker. Here's another clinical correlation. Secondarily, retroperitoneal organs can become relevant during surgical operations within the abdominal cavity that require mobilization of an organ. This mobilization is accomplished by cutting along the surface of the body wall that adheres closely to the relevant portion of the organ, allowing the surgeons to move the organs as needed for the duration of the procedure. How about another quiz? What is clinically significant about injury to a structure in the retroperitoneum? Injury to any of the 11 retroperitoneal structures can cause blood or gas accumulation in the retroperitoneal space. Part 4. What are the functional, anatomic, and histologic features of the esophagus? Now, let's look at the individual organs of the GI tract, starting at the top. The esophagus is a muscular tube that moves a bolus of food from the pharynx to the stomach by peristalsis, which is a wave-like muscular contraction and relaxation. The esophagus begins at the level of C6 and ends at the gastroesophageal junction, or GE junction. The esophagus has two sphincters, one on each end of the organ. The upper esophageal sphincter is made of skeletal muscle and controls food passing through the pharynx to the esophagus. The lower esophageal sphincter is made of smooth muscle and separates the esophagus from the stomach. Let's stop for a quick quiz. Which of the two esophageal sphincters allows a bolus of food to move past the GE junction into the stomach? The lower esophageal sphincter allows a bolus of food to move past the GE junction into the stomach. Okay, so histologically, the esophagus is composed of non-keratinized stratified squamous epithelium. Squamous cells have a width greater than the height and contain an ovoid centered nucleus. They are also stratified, meaning several layers of squamous cells. And unlike the skin, there is no keratin layer protecting the squamous cells, hence non-keratinized. The GE junction, also called the Z-line, shows a direct transition from stratified squamous cells to columnar epithelium cells. Here's another clinical correlation to end this section. When there is chronic exposure to gastric acid, such as gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD, the esophagus undergoes metaplasia, which is a change in cell type. The stratified squamous cells cannot tolerate their prolonged exposure to gastric acid and are replaced by columnar epithelium with goblet cells. This change is referred to as Barrett's esophagus and is associated with an increased risk for developing esophageal cancer. Part 5. What are the functional, anatomic, and histologic features of the stomach? Food from the esophagus continues into the stomach. There, the bolus is mechanically and chemically digested into chyme to prepare it for a later absorption in the small intestine. Diving deeper into the anatomy of the stomach. The stomach consists of 5 parts: the fundus, cardia, body, antrum, and pylorus. The fundus lies superior to the GE junction within the abdominal cavity as a slight bulge and is the most superior portion of the stomach. It is capable of expansion and acts as a reservoir for gas production that occurs during chemical digestion. The cardia is the aspect of the stomach closest to the GE junction, directly adjacent to the opening of the lower esophageal sphincter. This area of the stomach first encounters a swallowed bolus. It has limited digestive function. The largest part of the stomach, the body, sits between the fundus and the antrum. Think of it as a holding chamber for food as it starts to break down. The most inferior aspect of the stomach, the antrum, sits between the body and the pylorus. It collects chyme and creates the most forceful muscle contraction in the stomach. And the last part of the stomach, the pylorus, this area of the stomach is directly proximal to the pyloric sphincter, through which it transmits chyme to the small intestine, the duodenum specifically. Here's another quiz to see if you got that. Which of the 5 parts of the stomach is situated superior to the GE junction in a healthy adult? The fundus of the stomach is situated superior to the GE junction. Histologically, the stomach consists of simple columnar epithelial cells with gastric pits. Columnar cells are elongated cells where the width is smaller than the height, with the nucleus that is ovoid and positioned at the base. The gastric pits are adjacent to and in communication with gastric glands, which are present lower in the mucosal layer of the stomach. The gastric glands feature distinct cell types that release multiple secretions vital to digestion and ultimately absorption via the small intestine. Cells such as parietal cells are located primarily in the body of the stomach and secrete hydrochloric acid and intrinsic factor. Intrinsic factor is essential for the absorption of vitamin B12, an essential vitamin needed for the construction of red blood cells. There are also chief cells, which are also located primarily in the body of the stomach and secrete pepsinogen. There are the G cells, which are located primarily in the antrum and secrete gastrin. And lastly, the mucus-secreting cells, which are located primarily in the antrum, they secrete bicarbonate and, you guessed it, mucus. Part 6. What are the functional, anatomic, and histologic features of the small intestine? The small intestine, interestingly named, is part of the GI tract where greater than 90% of the digestion and absorption of food occurs, the rest taking place in the stomach and the large intestine. With this significant responsibility, it makes sense that the main function of the small intestine is absorption of nutrients and minerals from food. Let's discuss the small intestine's anatomy. The small intestine is comprised of 3 parts: the duodenum, jejunum, and ileum. The duodenum is connected to the stomach proximally and the jejunum distally. It receives secretions from the liver and pancreas to start chemically digesting food passed from the stomach. Chyme enters to the duodenum from the stomach via the pyloric sphincter. The duodenum has four parts. The first part of the duodenum is in the right upper quadrant and is intraperitoneal, lying on top of the common bile duct and the gastroduodenal artery. It is associated with the greater omentum and hepatoduodenal ligament of the lesser omentum. The second part of the duodenum is the most important because it receives secretions from the bile duct and the main pancreatic duct. The second and third parts of the duodenum wrap around the head of the pancreas, and the third part continues horizontally. The third part of the duodenum is generally found at the level of L3. The fourth and final part of the duodenum leads into the jejunum. This junction between the most distal aspect of the duodenum and the most proximal aspect of the jejunum is known as the duodenal-jejunal flexure. Let's pause for another quiz. What is the name of the anatomical structure that represents the joining of the duodenum and the jejunum? The duodenojejunal flexure represents the joining of the duodenum and the jejunum. Moving on to the jejunum and ileum. The jejunum and ileum are two more distal aspects of the small intestine. They serve important functions in nutrient absorption. The jejunum is responsible for folate absorption. The ileum absorbs vitamin B12 and bile salts. A common misconception is that large intestine is the primary site of water absorption. This is not true. The vast majority of water that progresses through the GI tract is absorbed by the jejunum and the ileum. The small intestine has four layers. From external to internal, they are the serosa, muscularis externa, submucosa, and the mucosa. Histologically, the small intestine is composed of simple columnar epithelium. Highly important structures present throughout the majority of the small intestine are the plicae circularis, circular folds of the submucosal layer that project out into the lumen of the small intestine. They are most highly concentrated throughout the jejunum, and their concentration decreases toward both the proximal and distal ends of the small intestine. Lying over the plicae circularis is the lamina propria, which is a mucosal layer that underlies the basement membrane of the simple columnar epithelia throughout the small intestine. Villi are projections of the lamina propria. Microvilli can be thought as villi of the villi. Villi and microvilli maximize the absorptive surface area. Envision fingers on the surface wall, as well as projecting off the plicae circularis, they would represent the villi. Think of villi as being filled with lamina propria, but note that the villi are smothered all over the simple columnar epithelium. Microvilli are found on the luminal or apical surfaces of epithelial cells that make up the villi. Microvilli form the brush border and are kind of like spiky haircuts for all of the epithelial cells. Other important histologic structures are the crypts of Lieberkühn, invaginations of the mucosal layer adjacent to villi that are present throughout the length of the small intestine. Stem cells at the base of the crypts are responsible for the generation and regeneration of four different cell types. First, there are the Paneth cells. They are uniquely located, remaining localized to the base of the crypts adjacent to the stem cells. They produce defensins, lysozymes, and tumor necrosis factor, also known as TNF. Second are the goblet cells. They ascend crypts with ongoing stem cell division to become incorporated into the villi. They secrete mucus. Third are the enteroendocrine cells. They ascend crypts with ongoing stem cell division to become incorporated in villi. They secrete various hormones that regulate hunger, digestion, and GI tract motility. Fourth and finally, the enterocytes are the most frequently produced. They ascend crypts with ongoing stem cell division to become the primary cell to be incorporated into the villi. They feature microvilli and form the brush border, and they function in absorption, secretion, and water balance. The Brunner glands found within the submucosal layer are specific to the duodenum. They are responsible for secreting bicarbonate to neutralize the acidic contents received from the stomach. Pyre patches are lymphoid aggregates at the base concentrated within the ileum that provide a protective immune function. They appear as light pink-colored group of cells at the base of the mucosal layer of the small intestine. How about another quiz? What are the four different cell types that are generated from the stem cells at the base of the crypts of Lieberkuhn? Paneth cells, goblet cells, enteroendocrine cells, and enterocytes. All are essential in absorption, enzymatic, and hormonal functions of the GI tract. Part 7. What are the functional, anatomic, and histologic features of the large intestine? Hey, look, we're nearing the end of the GI tract. Thanks for hanging in there with me. So now we're at the large intestine. The large intestine's main function is to prepare chyme that has been largely stripped of its nutrients for defecation. It also plays a minor role in absorbing any remaining water and electrolytes present in the food material. The large intestine is connected proximally to the small intestine and distally to the rectum. Chyme enters the large intestine via the ileocecal valve and consists of the colon, rectum, and anal canal. The colon is further subdivided into five areas. We'll now move through them in a proximal to distal direction. First, we have the cecum, also known as the blind pouch of the large intestine. It receives chyme from the ileum via the ileocecal valve. It is also associated with the lymphoid appendix, a hollow muscular structure suspended from the inferior aspect of the cecum. Moving along, we get to the ascending colon, which is located in the right lateral aspect of the abdominal cavity. Functionally, the ascending colon is the area of the large intestine most responsible for absorbing any remaining water or electrolytes from the food material. Next in line is the transverse colon. The transverse colon travels horizontally across the right and left upper quadrants of the abdominal cavity and is the link between the ascending and descending colons. It plays a minor role in water and electrolyte absorption, although to a lesser degree in comparison with the ascending colon. It also participates in gastric motility. Following the transverse colon is the descending colon. It's situated in the left lateral aspect of the abdominal cavity. It serves as a conduit for fecal matter from the transverse colon to the sigmoid colon. And lastly, we get to the sigmoid colon. This is an S-shaped aspect of the large intestine that primarily functions to store fecal matter that has been prepared for defecation. The contractions of the sigmoid colon play a minor role in excreting feces from the body. Here's another quiz to see if you got that. What are the five parts of the colon? The five parts of the colon are the cecum and associated appendix, ascending colon, transverse colon, descending colon, and sigmoid colon. Moving toward the back, but further along down the large intestinal route, we get to the rectum. The rectum is a retroperitoneal organ that exits the abdominal cavity and leads to the anal canal. The dilated distal portion is referred to as the ampulla. In addition, the rectum features unique permanent transverse folds known as Houston valves, which are thought to support fecal matter prior to the voluntary initiation of defecation. The rectum joins the anal canal at the anal-rectal juncture. Finally, we reach the anal canal. The anal canal is the last and final stop for food material on its long journey prior to being excreted back into the environment. The anal canal spans the gap between the anal-rectal junction and the anus. The proximal two-thirds are under autonomic control, and the distal third is under somatic control. These areas are demarcated by an area called the pectinate line. Defecation proceeds because of the passage of fecal matter through the internal, which is involuntary, and external, which is voluntary, anal sphincters. As for the histology of the large intestine, Histologically, the colon lacks villi but has crypts of Lieberkuhn, often known as colonic crypts. These are known for their substantial concentration of goblet cells seen as little white dots or egg-shaped structures along the length of the crypts. The histology of the rectum demonstrates features consistent with the remainder of the large intestine, but the anal canal, like the esophagus, is lined with non-keratinized stratified squamous epithelium. This tissue type is ideal for areas that are subject to forceful and abrasive luminal functions. And that brings us to the end of our discussion on the anatomy and histology of the GI tract. Again, thanks for hanging in there with me. Now, let's recap to see if we've completed our goals. 1. Can you name the two major omenta of the peritoneum and where they are located? 2. The lesser omentum extends from the lesser curvature of the stomach and first part of the duodenum to the liver. The greater omentum starts from the greater curvature of the stomach and duodenum, travels inferiorly, folds on itself, and then goes back up superiorly to attach to the transverse colon. 2. Can you name the four greater omentum ligaments of the peritoneum and where they are located? 1st, the gastrosplenic ligament connects the greater curvature of the stomach to the spleen. 2nd, the splenorenal ligament connects the spleen to the left kidney. 3rd, the gastrophrenic ligament connects the greater curvature of the diaphragm. And finally, the 4th, gastrocolic ligament connects to the greater curvature of the stomach to the transverse colon. Also, remember, the lesser omentum ligaments, hepatogastric ligament connects to the lesser curvature of the stomach to the liver, and the gastroduodenal ligament connects the duodenum to the liver. 3. Can you name the organs that are housed in the retroperitoneum? Remember the mnemonic said pucker. S for suprarenal gland, A for aorta, I for inferior vena cava, D for duodenum, P for pancreas, U for ureters, C for colon, the descending and ascending, K for kidneys, E for esophagus, and R for rectum. 4. Are you able to describe the inner histologic layer of the esophagus and the type of cells that line the esophagus? The esophagus is lined with non-keratinized stratified epithelium. 5. Can you name the cell type in the stomach and also the name of the molecule that is responsible for vitamin B12 absorption? 6. The parietal cells of the stomach are responsible for the secretion of intrinsic factor, which is essential for the absorption of vitamin B12. 6. Are you able to name the finger-like projections lining the small intestine that maximize the absorptive surface area? 7. The villi and microvilli are finger-like projections that line the inner layer of the small intestine that maximize the absorptive surface area, since this is a major function of the small intestine. 7. And finally, can you name the 5 portions of the colon? The cecum, ascending colon, transverse colon, descending colon, and the sigmoid colon are the 5 portions of the colon. Whew, and that's it. Armed with your newfound knowledge on the anatomy and histology of the GI system, let's get back to the patient from the beginning of this episode. You are seeing a 52-year-old woman for follow-up evaluation of fatigue. You have learned that 5 years ago, she underwent a sleeve gastrectomy in which 70 to 80% of the greater curvature of the stomach was removed. Her labs revealed that she is anemic with a hemoglobin of 8.2 and an elevated MCV of 111. How do you explain these findings, and what treatment do you recommend? You first follow up on the initial labs by ordering a B12 level, which is determined to be low. You turn to discuss the diagnosis and treatment plan with your patient. Do your best to follow me because there are several steps that will explain why you're so tired. When you had your weight loss surgery, a large part of your stomach was removed. The part that was removed, certain cells called parietal cells that are responsible for the secretion of a substance called intrinsic factor, which in turn is necessary for the absorption of vitamin B12. If you don't have enough B12, your blood counts drop and you can become anemic. We can correct this with either oral B12 or with shots. The patient confirms, "Ah, yes, now I remember. My surgeon recommended I take some B12, but I just never did. I should have listened." But that's water under the bridge. Let's get started with my treatment now. You agree with her go-getter statement. Several months later, with B12 supplementation, you observe the hemoglobin normalizes and her fatigue resolves. And that's it for our show. Make sure you like and subscribe if you like what you hear, and remember, your feedback helps us to improve. You can enjoy the full BRIC experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already. Until next time,